Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. With more than 30 weekly podcasts, HRN has something for every food lover. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. We've been making cheese in Wisconsin since before we were even a state, which may be one reason why we win so many awards for it. It's what happens when a whole state dreams in cheese. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio, on this journey through culinary history. And today we're going to be talking about curry. If I say curry to you, you most likely will be thinking of an Indian dish, perhaps. Well, curry is a word that is imbued with many meanings and mixed emotions. From the time of colonialism, it was long used to describe Indian food in general. And that's a term that often had a derogatory connotation to those of Indian descent. Today, fortunately, we recognize the regionality and diversity of the cuisine of India. And yet, largely through savory, that enigmatic dish curry remains one of the most global of dishes, despite its many guises from one country to the next. And the food writer, Sejal Sukudwala, has done a little unraveling of this history, and she describes the history, the etymology, and the conflicts of curry in her book, The Philosophy of Curry, by the British Library series, The Philosophy Series. Sejal is a food writer who lives in London, and she frequently writes about Indian food and restaurants. She was born in India. She's written for a wide range of publications in the UK and the US and India, including The Guardian, The Times, and BBC Food. Sejal is also writing an Indian food dictionary, which here is an ongoing project. Welcome, Sejal.
Thank you. Thanks, Linda.
When I first asked you what got you going on this idea of curry being had been for a long time a word that Indian people of Indian descent would rather not use, and you said, well, you talked about being the first writer of Indian descent to write about it. Can you expand on that a little bit for me?
Yeah, when I first started researching the book, I was looking for Indian voices on this topic. I wanted to incorporate Indian views and Indian people's thoughts, and I couldn't find anything. I discovered that very few people have actually written about curry. People have written about Indian food history, but few people have actually focused on the topic, and those few people are mostly from American and British backgrounds. They're white, mainly white Americans and white British people, and there's one diaspora Indian person who's one or two who've written about the curry, about the topic, but there aren't any Indian people who've written about curry, especially ones living in India, and I thought that was really interesting. But it's a very as we'll see later on, it's a term that was adapted from an Indian word by the Portuguese and the British. So it's very much a kind of Western word for an Indian dish. Yeah. And although it's been embraced by people in India, it's they haven't really made it their own. So I think many people continue calling dishes by their own individual names. And very few
say their individual names, such as the flavor, the types, how it's prepared. Like,
there are different regional examples. Like, for instance, vegetable curry in North India, for instance, would be called sabzi, and then in Gujarat, for instance, vegetable curry would be called shak. So there are lots of words, individual words like that, which describe, you know, either vegetable curries or meat curries, depending on their texture, the consistency, ingredients, cooking techniques, and so on. So there are lots of regional variations in their names. Like, for instance, Salan, which is a Hyderabadi curry, always contains dried coconut and peanuts. So the word curry, the generic term curry, is not used very often. But because of British and international influences, people do use curry in India. But mostly when they use the word curry, they mean restaurant-style curries, which is, you know, like curries, I mean, dishes cooked in onion, tomato gravies, like North Indian style.
Right.
Which is a dominant style in restaurants.
Yes, indeed. And in fact, it became, well, largely through colonialism, obviously, it became probably more popular in Britain than any place else in the world for you know, a couple hundred years.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. You mentioned that the word came from an older type of a word from the Tamil language, yeah. Perhaps, curry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And can you talk a little bit more about that etymology and the history and what we know, what you've been able to glean from research?
Yeah. The word, the Tamil word curry, simply meant, first of all, it means charcoal, not as in charcoal cooking, but charcoal as in the color black. So it was applied, the term was applied to dishes which had black pepper in it. So either it was prefaced with, you know, the dishes with black pepper were either prefaced with the word curry or had the word curry somewhere in the name. And these dishes were either, you know, dishes with gravies or pickles, basically anything, any kind of relish that you ate with rice. So anything with black pepper basically was given the name curry. And this included a wide range of dishes. I mean, it was like, for instance, there would be soups, there would be lentil, you know, thin lentil broths, thicker lentil broths, vegetable stews, you know, all kinds of different dishes. And when the Portuguese came to India in the 15th century, they eventually used the word, they took the Tamil word curry and then they changed it to Kareel. Now, there are two theories about this. You know, either Kareel is a Kannada language word for the Tamil word curry, or it's singular word for curry, and then they changed it to curry as in C-U-R-E-E. Mm-hmm. And then the British came and changed C-U-R-E-E curry into curry, which is spelled C-U-R-R-Y. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of adapting going on.
Right.
And yeah. But it comes from the Tamil word curry, which means black pepper, basically. And there are different food historians who've given different explanations as well. Like, for instance, some people say it just means to eat by biting, or it means dishes with gravy, you know, like sauce. When I say, by the way, I use the word gravy, which sounds like a British word, because the word sauce can be used. But the reason why I don't use the word sauce is because in India, when people use the word sauce, they mean tomato ketchup. So I differentiate. I like to differentiate my con by using
and
the
that,
word.
And that has a whole history in itself, so we won't go there.
No, right? No, that's right, yeah.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because in looking for, you know, the origins of the word curry, you know, one of the oldest manuscripts in English in cookery was the form of curry, right?
Yeah, from, yeah, that's
1390.
Right.
And I thought, wait, form of curry. Well, but then the old English word or the middle English word for curry meant cookery.
Cookery, yeah, that's right.
So it's very confusing, yes, to be certain. Right. Well, some of the, but now when we, the curry dishes that we know of, curried goat, curried chicken, but with different spices and flavorings, mm-hmm. obviously the spice trade influenced this whole history of curries tremendously, right?
Yeah, that's right, yeah. I mean, when the colonials first went to India, they went looking for spices. The Portuguese were the first to arrive in India, and they came looking for spices. And then the British and the Dutch came as well. I mean, the Dutch went to Indonesia, but they were looking for spice as well. So the spice trade was a foundation of colonialism, and they adapted traditional Indian dishes to such an extent that, you know, eventually they started being called curry. So this generic umbrella term, which I think is a category, you know, category of dishes, but it was just applied generically, whether it was South Indian dish or whether it was North Indian or Bengali or Gujarati or whatever, it didn't make any difference. You know, it was all curry to the British, who didn't really understand the regional differences or the nuances or, I mean, even, you know, the... because there's a huge amount of variation depending on which region, which city, which caste or community or sub-community someone comes from. So there's huge amount of difference. And I think even in India, you know, people's knowledge is often limited to their own community or their own sort of family. So I think, you know, for outsiders to come in and try and grasp this, you know, this level of knowledge, all these details, it's just impossible. I mean, it could take years and years. So in a way, it's not surprising that they just, you know, think any kind of meat or vegetable dish cooked in a gravy, they just called it curry.
Yeah, that is pretty generic.
yeah, that's right. It's a bit like in India, after the British left, it was really fashionable to cook in the oven. In the 1970s, eventually became fashionable to cook, you know, cook baked dishes in the oven. And all Indians called anything baked in the oven a baked dish. So they use this generic term, and it didn't really matter whether it was macaroni cheese they were cooking or souffle or pizza or lasagna. You know, it was all baked dish. You know, mm-hmm. They use the term baked dish, and it's a bit like that. You know, when people use the term curry, it's a huge variety of dishes, and they're just given this generic name. And this is one of the reasons why many, especially diaspora Indians, have rejected the term, and they don't like using it because they think, you know, it simplifies really complex cuisine into this, you know, one umbrella term.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And also there were some racist connotations attached to it as well, right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there's a number of things, you know, the use of spices led non-Indians to tease Indians in playgrounds, as well as actually in, you know, in some European cities, in apartment blocks as well. The neighbors started teasing them about the smell of curry, you know, which has made people really self-conscious about cooking curries. I know of people who won't cook curries in, they just won't cook curries in the house because it might offend the neighbors. Then, you know, it's a very dismissive, I mean, it can be a dismissive term because it can feel like a dismissive term because you're reducing a cuisine into, you know, that one category. And also because of its association with colonialism.
Yes.
It's a kind of, you know, lots of diaspora Indians especially, they feel like, you know, the cuisine has been appropriated it's been twisted and mangled and ruined, basically, you know, by the British coming along and simplifying the dishes and just calling everything curry. So there are lots of people who are really angry about that, mm-hmm. and they won't use the word. But also, you know, they didn't grow up using the term curry because their parents used, you know, individual names for individual dishes. So if you're from Gujarat, you know, you might have called vegetable curry shark or a pulse, you know, something made with pulses or legumes would be called kator. So you'd use all these different terms and you wouldn't necessarily use the word curry. But having said that, you know, there are lots of Indian people who did grow up with the term curry. Like I was, you know, my family has used curry to describe North Indian style restaurant curries. But mm-hmm. for everyday cooking, the food that my mum cooks, that's, you know, she uses like individual words, individual terms for individual dishes. But for North Indian style tomato onion gravy dishes, my parents would use the term curry.
Even so, to the point where as early as the mid-1700s, I guess it was the British or South India, came up with the powder, the curry powders. Let's talk about curry powder, that kind of sometimes heinous substance, sometimes very good if it's a garam masala that's made, you know, by somebody who knows their spices. But let's talk about that because it helps define some of the, you know, what we're talking about, the dishes.
Yeah, I would actually distinguish between garam masala, which is an Indian invention, and curry powder, which is a British, it has British origins.
Right.
Because there are all these different spice blends in Indian cooking, which again, you know, they all vary because of, you know, they're all from different regions.
Of course.
So yeah, there's Kashmiri, garam masala, then there's, Vaduva masala from Pondicherry in the south. Then there are Podi masalas from Maharashtra. Then in Gujarati cooking, you just use cloves and cinnamon ground together, and there's Gujarati garam masala. There's Punjabi garam masala, which is a lot more, there are a lot more spices. So there are all these different, and in Bengal, you get Panchfuran, which is a mix of five whole spices. Mm. So there are various different regional spice blends. And no one uses the word curry powder because curry powder is a British invention, which basically is, I've seen ingredients for lots of different curry, you know, spice blends called curry powder. And the only thing they have in common is that they use turmeric powder. But other than that, I mean, it's just a random mix of spices. It's just, right. It could be anything. It could be coriander, cumin. I mean, there's no such thing as a, I mean, there's no such thing as curry powder because it was invented by the British. And around 18th century, and then it really started taking off in the 19th century. And the reason why they concocted this spice blend is because they found Indian cooking too complex at the British colonials, and they found Indian cooking too hot and pungent, and they wanted to adopt it to their own taste. So they took the spice blends that the servants and the spice, you know, there were specialist spice blenders and spice makers who grind spices on stones and pestle and mortars in Indian families in those days. But they took their techniques and the general idea of grinding spices, and they adapted recipes to suit their own taste. So they made them mild, you know, like milder.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually when they got used to sort of hot food as well, there were all these different levels of, well, there were all these different heat levels. So there was mild curry powder, medium and hot. But it was basically created by British colonials. And in the early days, when the East India Company men who returned to England, they were still buying individual spices from the chemists. So there were no, they weren't using curry powders. But it was only around, I would say, 18th and 19th century that curry powder, especially 19th century, it started taking off. It was around in the 18th century, but it was not that popular or that well known. But in the 19th century, it just became ubiquitous, and it was available. Yeah, it was available in department stores and in even in corner shops by the end of 19th century.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, with all of this dumbing down, as you say, of the flavors of certain spices, particularly some of the spices from South India, perhaps.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think you had mentioned sambar and rasam.
The Madras curry powder, which was the first one, I think, to be invented, because Madras curries were really like favorite. They were like a favorite of Anglo-Indians. And Anglo-Indians are people of mixed European and Indian heritage. So, but in the early days, the British colonials called themselves Anglo-Indians, so there's a bit of confusion around that. But now, you know, the term means people of mixed European, not just British, but European and Indian heritage.
Right.
But the early Anglo-Indians invented Madras curry because they loved curries made in the presidency town of Madras, which has now changed its name to Chennai, but in those days it was called Madras. Mm-hmm. And they loved the curries there, and I think they were the favorite. So the first curry powder to be invented was Madras curry powder. Then there was Bengal curry powder, which was based on Bengali spice mixes, and Bombay curry powder, which was based on Maharashtrian and Gujarati spice mixes. But they've gone extinct. So the only one that remains is Madras curry powder. And I think that's just because Madras curries were the most popular. And, you know, we still, I mean, I've read, you know, like, works by Anglo-Indians in 19th century where they just rave about Madras curry and how, you know, the old kind of cooks in Madras knew how to cook curries properly. And once they, you know, once they died, they didn't pass on the recipes to their children and grandchildren. So the curries weren't the same anymore. Mm. And they were complaining about how, you know, there were no written down recipes for these old Madras curries. So they tried to replicate that, those, you know, those tastes, but according to their taste. So, you know, they just made them less pungent and less hot.
Right. Well, you know, it's interesting with the colonists who were there, the British who embraced this food. I mean, they embraced it to the point where they, you know, they took it home with them and hired the, you know, a cook, you said, largely Muslim. Why do you think the British embraced it so much?
Because it's delicious.
Good answer.
Yeah. I think, initially, you know, it was the fascination with spices and what spices could do because, you know, they came looking for spices. So they were just entranced by the flavors, which were exotic on one hand, but also familiar because medieval Arab cookery, which has spices in it as well, which had spices rather, that influenced medieval English cooking. So the British, to an extent, were used to some spices, you know.
Right. I mean, that was back there in their background somewhere because, you know, you look at some of those middle English dishes and they did include a lot of spices when the spice trade was so hot, you know, until it became not hot anymore.
Right? That's right, they would have been used to kind of milder blend of spices and just different tastes, you know, because Indian food contained in those days lots of black pepper and different, you know, different kind of spices which gave the food some heat, like mustard and ginger and black peppercorns, cubeb pepper, long pepper. This is before the chilies arrived in India. So it would have given it a kind of exotic and yet familiar taste. So I think partly they were entranced by what spices could do and how, you know, they could liven up food. And then towards the end of the stay, because the food in Britain was influenced by French cooking more and more, I think Indian food just contrasted with what they were used to. You know, they were used to not spicy food, but food which was rich in butter and dairy products and sauces. So spicy food was just complete contrast. So it was a mixture of like exotic and familiar.
Yes. Yes. And I mean the Persian influence certainly, you know, on spices is very noticeable. But it was interesting also to read, and I hadn't really given it much thought that, you know, because we read so much about the spice trade and the influence of spices on foods in many cultures, and how it became, we know, certain of the upper class that if you could afford these exotic spices, you know, it was a show of wealth, until suddenly the spice, you know, when the spice trade took off and the spices were readily available, it was not so special anymore. And in fact, it became, as you said, a rather common, ordinary place or vulgar type of food.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, because curries and spices had a kind of roller coaster relationship with with the British. You know, they went in and Indian food went in and out of fashion. There was a time when they were fascinated, with the spicy flavors, and they were impressed by these flavors. They wanted to replicate these flavors, and it was these flavors were lacking in their own cuisine. And then there were other times when they were seen as too vulgar and too, you know, like arousing passions and too ubiquitous. Mm-hmm. There were the spices were everywhere, and they were seen as too common and too loud and too sort of. Yeah, just too vulgar, like you said. And then there was a fashion for like subtly or more kind of subtly spiced or more nuanced dishes. So, you know, use of less chili, one point in the 19th century. So, there were all these kind of differences in attitudes. Like, you know, one minute they were fashionable, next minute they weren't, you know, they'd gone out of fashion. And partly it's also to do with, I mean, not just French influence, but it's to do with their attitude towards India as well. I mean, they came to India and they were like in awe of everything. You know, India was extremely wealthy in those days, and they wanted a piece of the action. You know, they wanted spices. They wanted some of the wealth. They wanted to make money. They wanted to get rich quick, you know, this kind of thing. And then the later colonials thought themselves to be superior to Indians, and they wanted to discipline, you know, introduce discipline to India, and they wanted to control Indians more, you know. So there was a difference in attitude from early colonials to later colonials. So that affected their attitude towards the food as well. So at the beginning, the early colonials loved it, and they ate Indian food, but the later colonials thought it was too heavy to digest, and it was too greasy, and it was too kind of uncouth and unsophisticated for British palates. So they started looking down on it.
Well, I mean, of course, as you said too, the influence of, you know, the French haute cuisine was, you know, started to take over. We're going to take a brief break and come back to this discussion, because I also want to talk about how different dishes, called curries also, really started to take on roots in many countries around the globe. So stay tuned. We'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. There's a reason when you think of Wisconsin, you think cheese. Cheese is a huge part of Wisconsin's history and future. In Wisconsin, the state of cheese, the tradition of cheesemaking excellence began 180 years ago. Before Wisconsin was recognized as a state, immigrants traveled to settle in this lush green hills of Wisconsin, bringing their cheesemaking traditions with them. These storied skills, combined with the freshest milk available, created a cheesemaking culture that is uniquely Wisconsin. Wisconsin's 1,200 cheesemakers, many of whom are third and fourth generation, continue to pass on old world traditions while adopting modern innovations in cheesemaking craftsmanship. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
Hi, we're back. And I'm talking with Sejal Sukadwala, and we're talking about the philosophy of curry. Yes, it's more than just what you think of as a dish. There's a whole philosophy behind it, right? And we're hearing it, right. I said I wanted to talk about more about some of the dishes. I mean, you said that so many of the food writing and food history came rather late, you say, to the subcontinent. And you didn't find too many Indian voices to write about it. But then as far as those who would deny, be the, you know, the curry deniers, as far as a word describing a whole cuisine, of course, we don't want to use one word to describe a whole cuisine. That, you know, it's erroneous. But I found it interesting, because so many of the dishes involve New World foods, as you pointed out earlier, you know, tomatoes, potatoes, chilies. And you said, what would we want to do? Reduce it and take it back to those origins? I mean, you know.
Yeah.
And it's a very interesting concept, you know, that there's a reason for not understanding it, another reason for, well, it started to come on and take on a life of its own. So much so that there are cultures in Malaysia and Indonesia and certainly, you know, Trinidad and Japan, even, who really embraced the use of spiced sauces and their own, and have developed their own curries and tastes of curries.
Yeah, Indian food has, I mean, I think it's, personally, I see it as a gift, you know, which Indian cuisine has given to the rest of the world, although not in ideal circumstances, you know, because often the curry powders and curry pastes and these dishes travel to other countries via indentured laborers,
yes,
which were basically, you know, slave laborers, who were paid really badly. But they, you know, they traveled to these countries, or they were sent to these countries by the British colonials, and they used ingredients from local cuisines and adapted their dishes, which then got embraced by the native communities, you know, of those nations. So curries are really popular in, you know, like all over the world, and, you know, they all have their takes on them, and they use like local ingredients and then Indian influences, and they combine the two, and it's really fascinating, you know, just how the whole genre has developed. And I think the chapter on curries around the world is probably the most surprising that people have told me that they've found, because they just associated curry with Indian food. And there are all these different curries, especially, you know, Japanese people. I've had so many comments from Japanese readers who've, I think I've got more like fans from Japan for this book than anywhere else, because they love curry. It's really, really popular there.
I mean, certainly Malaysia, you know, we know of the Penang region and the Penang curry being, you know, very specific. And I think one of the iterations that I'm not quite sold on yet is the German currywurst.
Well, oh yes,
I did have to try it when I was there, and I said, eh, you know, it was like a spicy ketchup sauce. You know, it was not, it didn't really do it for me.
Yeah,
but basically a sausage with some, you know, some spicy ketchup sauce. Not even that spicy at all. Yeah, so that was interesting. Not that great.
Yeah, maybe they should just use chili flavored ketchup.
I think so, right.
Yeah.
You wrote about the dishes. Oh, we were talking about the French cuisine coming in. Of course, then, as you mentioned, the dairy products were incorporated more heavy creams and things in the sauces.
Yeah.
In fact, so that it was added to an Indian dish or a dish of Indian origin, chicken tikka. And then it became so popular, and chicken tikka masala came about. Can you tell, there was that cute story that you told that about the most popular dish that was even on a citizenship test?
Yeah, that's right. Actually, recently, the supposed inventor of chicken tikka masala died a few weeks ago. And I mean, there are all sorts of mythologies about, you know, how the dish came about. And it was supposed to be, I mean, one theory is that it was invented by a Glasgow restaurateur called Ali Ahmed Aslam of a restaurant called Shish Mahal. And he passed away a few weeks ago. But then, he said in an interview that he invented the dish because a customer asked for sauce to go with his chicken tikka. Chicken tikka is just a chicken kebab, so it's a dry kebab. And the customer associated Indian food with gravies and, you know, spice sauces. So he thought the kebab was too dry, so he wanted a sauce to go with it. So Mr. Ali then took Campbell's tomato soup, cream of tomato soup, and added some spices to it, and then, you know, just made a gravy out of it, and then put the chicken tikka in it, and then served it to the customer, who loved it. And then he spread the word about this chicken tikka curry, chicken tikka masala, and that's how the dish was born. But I think it's, personally, I think it's been around a lot longer. You know, I don't think it's, I think this is just a story that he made up because it's a famous dish and everyone wants to claim that they invented it. So I actually think it's because, you know, first of all, in the in India, there are lots of kebab curries. Now, kebab curries go back to Mughlai period. So from 16th century onwards, you find kebab curries, which is basically leftover kebabs, in a, you know, made, served in a gravy. So kebab curries have existed for a long time, even before Mr. Ali came, you know, came along. So there's a tradition of, you know, these type of curries. Then there's also there's a theory that in Delhi's Moti Mahal restaurant, there was the restaurateur used leftover chicken tikka, which was cooked in a tandoor oven, because Moti Mahal was the first restaurant, Indian restaurant, to introduce tandoor oven. Because, you know, that became, and that actually came about because of the trade on the Grand Trunk Road, that there were lots of, you know, this restaurateur fled after Pakistan. He fled. He was a Hindu Muslim, and he fled Pakistan, and he came to Delhi, and he brought along his tandoor, and on his journey he cooked lots of meat and flatbreads, you know, naan breads. And as soon as he came to Delhi, he opened this restaurant called Moti Mahal, which is really famous for having invented chicken tikka, which is a type of chicken kebab. And he said that there was so much chicken tikka lying around, you know, because there was such a high demand for it, that he had to keep making loads and loads of chicken tikka in the tandoor oven. But there would be lots left over because he didn't know, you know, he couldn't gauge what the customer demand was going to be like. So with the leftover chicken tikka, he put it in tomato and cream and butter gravy. And that is the kind of predecessor of chicken tikka masala. That's another theory.
Well, I like that story better, actually.
Yeah, because the other one doesn't really make sense, I think.
Yeah. And then it became so popular in Great Britain that I don't know whether it's apocryphal or if it's a true story, that it was put as a question on the citizenship test.
No, it is. It's true. Yeah, because I've seen those questionnaires. Yeah. No, it's true. And even the, you know, my anecdote about the Persian grocer who passed his test because he answered chicken tikka masala. That's a true story as well.
As being the most popular dish in Great Britain, right?
Yeah, I mean, it was. Until recently, because now apparently, you know, chicken korma is number one curry, but it was so popular that it was on the citizenship test. And actually, this is how, you know, it's funny, because when British Library asked me to do this book, I wasn't sure about it. So I just said, look, you know, I'll think about it and I'll get back to you. And then on the very same evening, I left my house to go to just a few minutes walk down the road, there's a Persian grocer. So I walked in and I picked up a bunch of fenugreek leaves. And the owner of the shop had never spoken to me before. And he said, oh, are you making methi chicken? Methi chicken is just chicken curry with fenugreek leaves. So I said, no, I'm vegetarian, so I'm going to make fenugreek dumplings or something. And he was very disappointed, and he said, oh, I love methi chicken, you know, it's my favorite curry. And then he started going on about how, you know, he loved curries, and he ate Indian curries, you know, whenever he could. And and then he started telling me about this citizenship test, and he said, you know, there was this question on chicken tikka masala, and he knew that the answer to the question of what is British national dish was chicken tikka masala, because he knew about Robin Cook's speech, you know, which is a really famous speech, which gets quoted in every discourse about curry in Britain. But his friend didn't know that, and his friend just said fish and chips. So his friend failed, and he passed the test. But then, you know, since then I've seen evidence in printed questionnaires in you know, like newspaper reports and so on. So I know that he was telling the truth. But yeah, it's funny that, you know, that people who want to live in this country are asked this question about which is basically to do with curry history trivia, you know, and I'm really surprised that chicken tikka masala is so famous that it's a question on the citizenship test. I just find it funny.
Well, it's interesting that curry and is more than just, as I said, once again, more than just a dish, more than just a plant with leaves, which is often not even used in curry, right, in the dish.
Yeah, the curry leaves.
Yeah, that it takes on the stories, you know.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. And then it becomes its own thing, you know, when yeah. it travels to other countries and when people from other cultures adapt it to their own tastes, it just becomes a different thing. And this is why, you know, some people have said to me, oh, aren't you angry about Anglo-Indians, you know, like ruining your cuisine? And I'm like, well, no, because, you know, I've got Anglo-Indian friends and there's a thriving but small Anglo-Indian community in India, and you can't say to them that your cuisine is
not authentic, right?
Yeah, not authentic version of Indian food or Indian cuisine. You can't differentiate, like, you know, you can't say, oh, it's not authentic, it's not proper Indian food, it's not genuine Indian food or whatever, because it's, you know, it's their adaptation. And, you know, you can't say that an Indian version is superior or anything, because, you know, everyone has their own, they've taken something, you know, which I think India has given to them, and they've made it their own adaptation. And mm-hmm. I think we need to accept that.
Yes.
So I don't think which is why I think, you know, cancelling the word curry or making statements like, oh, curry doesn't exist, you know, I just think it's really naive.
That's right. As long as it's not used to, you know, as in a derogatory fashion.
Exactly.
You know, imitation is the best form of flattery, right?
Mm, yeah, that's right.
So, yeah. And we are such a world of immigrants and travelers that, you know, I think to take another person's cuisine and make it your own is a very interesting thing that happens.
Yeah, and also dishes change when they travel. I mean, you know, the way that diaspora Indian communities cook in Britain or in South Africa or in Kenya, for instance, it's different from how Indian people cook in India. And that's to do with availability of ingredients. It's to do with your
That's right. mm-hmm.
palates or your taste changing, or you might want to integrate the, you know, the ingredients from the country you're living in with the, you know, with original ingredients, with traditional ingredients, and you might want to create something new, which is called third cuisine. So there's nothing wrong with that. You know, it's just, I think this is how dishes evolve and, you know, that's how, you know, cuisine progresses, I think, and changes.
Well, it is a very powerful, mighty, but small. So a small book, but it's packed with a lot of information and a very unique approach to describing curry and the story around it.
Yeah, I wanted to write it from an Indian angle because I've read books on curry, you know, written by other people, and they haven't actually addressed no one has addressed the issue of does curry exist or why do people want to cancel it? And I think it's because those books were written a few years ago, and this discussion is quite new. It's kind of like come up in the last few years, partly because social media has really taken off, you know, Twitter and Facebook and Instagram, you know, so these discussions come up periodically on social media platforms. And so it's a fairly new discussion, which is kind of instigated by, I think, mostly, you know, diaspora Indians, although mm-hmm. the first person to question the term curry was probably Madhuri Jaffrey back in the 1970s. So it's not an entirely new discussion, but it's been coming up, you know, quite a lot recently. And so, you know, the previous authors haven't really addressed it to the extent that I have. And the other thing which I've done, which I'm really proud of, is really kind of delved into the roots of the term and the definition of the term and, you know, where it comes from. So yes. I've written it from an Indian angle and an Indian person's angle. And, you know, the conclusion and so on is that's yeah. very Indian. And that's what makes it different from some of the other books on curry.
And you've done a very nice job, I must say. I think it's now the responsibility of all of us on social media who are familiar with some of these Indian dishes to call them by their right name, right?
Yeah, yeah, that's right. The regional name.
The book is called The Philosophy of Curry by Sejal Sukadwala. And Sejal, thank you so much for taking the time to talk about this work. And And now we'll all cook a dish with something with some wonderful tastes and wonderful spices. Thank you, and have a good day.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me, and it's nice talking to you.
You're more than welcome. And thank you for listening. This has been another Taste of the Past.
A Taste of the Past is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.